What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. I'm Thomas.
I'm Tyson.
I studied exercise physiology and competed in many various sports ranging from wrestling to ultra running. I use that knowledge to combine today's science with ancient wisdom to live an optimal lifestyle and to spread that information onto the masses.
I'm a lifelong weightlifter and I'm obsessed with health and wellness. My degree in biology, with an emphasis in neurobiology, physiology, and behavior, allows me to take a deep dive into the most current literature and bring that information to you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to show your support, please rate and review on your favorite podcast provider, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or SoundCloud. Also, sign up on our website, tntwellnessandnutrition.com, for all of our up-to-date content.
Let's get this started. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. This is episode 43, and this is part 5 of 5 of our 5 worst foods to eat. We're going to be talking about soy infant formula, and obviously all the dangers and why soy is crap. I've been waiting months to talk about soy, so here's my shot. But so first, how's everything going with you, Tom?
Yeah, this last week was pretty good. It was Memorial Day weekend this last weekend, so a perfect time to barbecue. Went over to a friend's house, and it was nice actually having like a social gathering where everybody there was on this way of eating.
So without even knowing it?
Well, no, we already knew that they were.
Oh, okay,
so it was just
nice.
Kind of a little small get-together. Me and my girlfriend went over to another couple's house. They barbecued. It was like 95% carnivore. So it was just kind of nice like going to a social gathering, not having to worry about eating beforehand. And just like making sure like I eat a lot so I'm not tempted while I'm there. So it's just nice being able to like go to a social gathering and just eating normal.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Like didn't feel weird for just eating a burger, no bun.
Yeah.
Having a bunch of like bomb ass ribs.
How many people we talking?
4 adults and 2 kids.
Okay, so not that many people.
Yeah. No, it was a small get together. Okay. Unfortunately, not all my friends are on this way of eating. I think they're slowly transitioning, some of them.
Oh, we'll get them all, man. Just give it time. We'll convince everybody.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
That's about it.
That's cool.
What about you?
Again, man, life's Groundhog's Day. I did want to talk to you about, I guess, a little back and forth I had with some guy on Instagram lately. And sometimes I wish you ran this because you're way better at the back and forth than I am. Like, I know we talked about what you do on Facebook. Like, you know, you'll have back and forth with people. Like, I'm so, I don't know. I just don't do it. Like, I just don't want to put in that energy. Right. So I posted this picture, not really just a quick like Instagram story. So if you know, that's something that's just up for 24 hours, it's not a big deal. And it was just a picture showing how much sugar is in various drinks.
Oh, the donut one?
The donut. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Okay. So that wasn't a picture of me saying, hey, everyone, go eat donuts. I just was saying, yo, there's a lot of sugar in fruit juice. You know what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't, I didn't think a lot about the picture. I just saw it and posted it, right? It wasn't supposed to be a big deal. And this guy messaged me and, like, legit offended by it. And was like, you know, that's not a good representation of donuts. Like, there's so many more calories in donuts and those drinks. Like, you know, there's way more than just sugar. And I was like, oh, you're right. Like, I 100% agree with you. The donuts are the worst. And I was like, funny, we just talked about it. You know, like, but that wasn't a picture of me, like, saying he eat donuts. I was just saying, like, yo, like, people think fruit juice is inherently healthy, but, like, there's a ton of sugar in, like, that orange juice. That's just the simple, that's all I thought about when I posted that picture, right? And he was like, oh, he's like, yeah, but something about there are micronutrients, and in a healthy diet, fruit juice can be part of a healthy diet. And he said something about calories, right? And I was like, okay, I was like, you know, we can agree to disagree, but in my opinion, when someone's eating a human, I forget the words I use, like human...
Appropriate
diet, I think is exactly what I said. I was like, calories don't matter much, in my opinion, right? And you would agree with that.
Oh, that's a lot nicer than I would have been going about
it. Oh, so fucking nice.
I wouldn't have said my opinion at all. I just would have stated them as facts, because that's what they are.
That's what they are. Yeah, I know. I'm so soft. I don't know why I'm like this, but... And then he came back with, have you ever heard of Lane Norton? Does that ring a bell to you?
Oh, yeah. He's a joke.
Okay. See, I wish you would. I wish you would have done that.
So he had a debate with Dom DiAgostino. DiAgostino, one of the smartest guys when it comes to like ketogenic research. He works for the military. That's how smart he is. killed him in that one. Mm-hmm. Then he did another one against...
Paul, you mean he got killed?
D'Agostino won that one.
Yes.
Like, not even mm-hmm. close.
Yeah.
And then the other one, he got in a debate with Paul Saladino. Mm-hmm. Who do you think won that one?
Yeah, Paul Saladino.
Yeah.
And Paul Saladino...
That's what put him on the map.
Yeah, exactly. He's a pro-carnivore guy. He's actually the pro-est carnivore guy. And D'Agostino is a pro-keto guy, which is just like a brother of carnivore. So we obviously, our line of thinking aligns with those two guys. And but me being Mr. Nice Guy, I looked into Lane Norton a lot for our protein poisoning podcast. Because he does know a lot about protein metabolism. I'm not denying that, right?
Yeah.
Because you can, you know, like certain parts of someone's opinion, but not everything. You know what I mean? Yeah. You have to be willing to...
No, the guy is jacked, like, and he works with a lot of, like, top-level, like, bodybuilding-type athletes. Like, he knows his...
He does.
He knows some of his stuff.
But not everything.
Yeah.
And so I said, I was like, yeah, I am familiar with him, and he is a good resource if you're looking into protein metabolism, right? And I'm pretty sure the guy I was talking with kind of more of like a... Definitely not as well-read as me, like, straight up. You know what I mean? Like, I knew a lot. And he was like, he came back with, no, he's a good resource in everything nutrition.
He recommended Pop-Tarts on the debate against D'Agostino.
Yeah, he's like, if it fits your macros type of guy.
Yeah, exactly. He's that type of person. And honestly, like, if that guy wants to bring up micronutrients, what micronutrients are in Pop-Tarts?
I don't know.
I mean, maybe that fits your macros, but it's definitely not fitting your micros.
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, I don't know. It's... doesn't make a lot of sense. And Lane Norton, he is right with a lot of what he says if you're talking like pretty much elite level athletes. But if he's talking about regular people or people that are already
compromised,
like, yeah, exactly, compromised,
no,
that stuff's not going to apply to them. You can't eat, if you are a type 2 diabetic, you should not be eating Pop-Tarts even if they fit your macros. Like, avoid that shit and eat some real food.
Yes. Oh, no, exactly. And I wish, like, I guess I didn't. Once he said, like, oh, he's whatever, he's a good resource on everything nutrition, I just stopped the conversation. I was like, okay, you're done. Like, you're obviously kind of, you're locked in this mindset.
Yeah.
Like, you really don't want to have a conversation. So I just backed off. I said, all right, I didn't say anything. But he is right. Like, Lane Norton, when I put together diets for people, and I say diets specifically, because what we make is meal plans for the vast majority of people. Most people don't need a diet. But... when I do make diets for people, even including myself, some of Lane Norton's ideas, I'm definitely pulling from them. Because, you know, that's his world. You know what I mean? That's his world. He's like bodybuilding, prep, stuff like that. So that's his game. But those cases are so few and far between that most people should not listen to him, period.
No, not at all. And honestly, like, I follow a lot of people. There's nobody that I agree 100% with.
Yeah.
I mean, even somebody like as smart as Saladino... I think he's a little too extreme with it. When it basically, if it's not from an animal, then it's like not good for you.
Yeah.
And that basically just means that carbohydrates in any case are just bad for you, which I just don't agree with.
Yeah. And I can't remember exactly. He had something about the glycine to methionine ratio in protein that the first time I heard him didn't sound right to me. And I want to look into it when we do. Because after this podcast, we're going to do a 5 best foods podcast. And one of them is going to be a bone broth, like gelatin type episode. And I'm thinking in that episode, I'm going to take a deep dive into that glycine shit. And trust me, if anyone can find stuff that's going to either back him up or back me, I will. Yeah. I'll spend 5 hours on PubMed. Straight up, I'll do that deep dive. That doesn't bother me.
Well, it doesn't make a lot of sense that you need to add glycine or you need to add like these collagen type proteins. Because basically what he was saying was... we used to eat bones, and that we've been making bone broth for the longest time, and I don't really know how that would be possible.
I pose that same question to you. Like, how are we boiling bones and eating bones a million years ago?
Well, it takes, honestly, for, like, the bone broth that I make, it takes about 24 hours, and still, like, not all the marrow is out of some of the bones.
And you are in the most controlled position possible.
And those are smaller bones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if we're talking about, like, mammoth bones... that's a lot more marrow.
The femur be the size of you.
Yeah, I mean, like, what are we talking... I don't know if you have a pot big enough to fit that, first of all.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, like, you're going to be boiling this shit for, like, 3 days, hoping, like, the fire never goes out or anything like that. There's just a lot of things that just don't make a lot of sense.
They don't, exactly. So, I think I will look into that. I don't know how daunting of a task that'll be, but I am planning to dive into that a little bit. But,
Well, one of my things also is, with that, is he, like, supplements... with like collagen, he'll use like a collagen powder
and bone meal. He has bone meal.
But my thinking on it is, if you're not smart enough to get all your nutrition from real foods, then you don't understand nutrition good enough if you need to start supplementing with stuff like that.
If you think you need supplements?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why can't you figure out, like, real food sources? Because our ancestors would have, and they don't have all this information that we do today.
No, it was pretty much just what they had access to and how they felt.
And they don't have access to grocery stores where there's just unlimited amounts of everything.
No.
So, like, our resources are so much better. We should be so much smarter than them. So if we can't figure it out now, then maybe you don't understand quite everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. So, but yeah, so that was my, I guess, the highlight of my week was this little back and forth with this person. And I don't know, it's just not in me to try and convince people. Like, I almost feel like I'm wasting my breath, you know?
Well, I'll only go, like, I'm back and forth with somebody if it's actually going to be productive.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody's just, I'm 100% right, and I'm just going to prove to you how right I am, I don't even bother with that.
Yeah, that's what it felt like to him. And I understand, like, if you listen to Lane Norton and you don't, I don't know, you just don't have a broader understanding of health and nutrition, he is convincing as shit.
He is smart.
Like, yeah.
But there's also a lot of other people that are just as smart, if not smart, oh, smarter than
smarter he is. Smarter than he is, for sure.
A lot of what he says, like, yeah, it makes sense if you're working out 3 hours a day.
And is he lightweight on gear for these shows? Probably. Just let me put that out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of other people that are talking about what's going to work for the general public. What's going to work for 99% of people instead of that 1%.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. So that was my highlight. Besides that, training's going good. Diet's going good. No real problems. I spent a lot of time this week going over soy. And, yeah, I guess it's a good time to get into the topic of this podcast, which is going to be soy. And specifically soy baby formula, because whether you know it or not, 99% of all the soy formula out there is going to contain soy. It's either going to be 100% soy with soy protein or soy oil, or specifically they'll just have soy oil in it for like a fat source. And I came across this almost the hard way. Well, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but in a kind of in a roundabout way, I figured this out because I don't have kids. You don't have kids, right? So I don't have any experience buying baby formula. But one of my really good friends, David, I don't think he listens to this, but if you do, what's up? He had a kid. This was maybe, 3 years ago. And I was already into this game as far as nutrition and training and knowing that soy was poison. And I honestly, we talked about this on the Industrial Seed Oils. We forget that sometimes people don't know that.
Well, it's hard to remember stuff that we learned, it seems like a lifetime ago.
Forever.
I mean, yeah, it was like 5 years ago, something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And ever since we learned that, just kind of moved on.
Just moved on. Yeah, exactly. And so we were talking, and I guess his wife was having a problem producing milk. Does she follow a traditional low-fat diet? Sure does. Should she not have? Yes, but that's a whole different question and a whole different topic. But so he said they had to go to a soy or just a formula. And I was like, oh, man, that sucks. I was like, you know what, bro, just text me a picture of the ingredient list real quick. He's like, okay, yeah. I was like, whatever. And the first two ingredients were soy and soy, right? Because that's where they got the main protein and the main oil from. And I had such a, like, a visceral reaction to it. Like, heart rate went up, like, started sweating. Almost like, I've never had a panic attack, but the closest thing to a panic attack I ever had. And because I was so, I guess, just mad, that my really good friend was feeding his baby this poison under the assumption that it was healthy. Because he still thought that soy was a health food. And I was like, oh man, you have to stop. Like, you have to stop feeding her that. And he just, I don't know, like, if you became a cop all of a sudden, say in like 5 years you pulled me over, I don't look at you as a cop.
Oh yeah.
I'd be like, bro, kick rocks. Like, don't give me a ticket. But you have to, it's your job, right? Me, like, this is my shit. This is what I do. But he doesn't look at me that way. I'm the 5-year-old he knew from 30 years ago, you know? So me telling him, like, yo, you have to stop this. It was a real hard sell. And he, you know, he half listens to me. So I looked into, like, what are the options for baby formula? You trying to get a baby formula in America without soy? Good luck. It's damn near impossible. Good luck. I found some that were made in Australia that you had to buy off eBay that was made from actual whole milk, and I think of my whole goat milk, and that was the only brand, the only chance you could get to get any sort of formula that didn't have any sort of soy in it. Either, you know, soy protein or soy fat. And that just really, I mean, it really upset me. You know what I mean? Like, that's what we're feeding our kids. That's the next generation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're just setting them up for just, like, a whole host of problems right from the beginning. So, like, the popular recommendations for, like, if you run into that problem, would either be, like, raw goat milk or raw, like, A2 milk would be, like, another good option. Or camel milk if you can find it.
Yeah. Have you ever found camel milk?
I have not, but I've heard, I think it was Ben Greenfield talking about it.
Okay, that is an option.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are options out there to make your own type of formula from those sort of milks, and I recommend you do that if you're having problems producing milk or you have a baby and just this breast milk isn't working right now. But, so I've, ever since then, I was like, I have to spread the word on soy. Like, I have to be that guy, make sure everybody knows soy is crap. So, it was honestly kind of overwhelming putting notes together for this podcast because when I think everything about something's bad, where do you start?
I guess you just got to start from the basics.
Right?
Start from the beginning.
That's kind of what I did. So I split soy up into just its basic macronutrients. I was like, okay, what's wrong with the carbs in soy? What's wrong with the fats? And what's wrong with the protein? And so I guess we can start with the carbohydrates first off. And there's not that much carbs in beans and in these soybeans specifically, but the carbohydrates in soy lead to gas and bloating because they contain carbohydrates that our body simply can't digest. Specifically, they contain something called oligosaccharides, raffinose, and stachyose, and these carbs require the enzyme alpha-galactosidase to be digested properly. And unfortunately, humans and other mammals don't have this enzyme. Therefore, these sugars go through our GI tract intact. They don't get digested in our small intestines. And they hit our large intestines whole. And then they get fermented by the bacteria in our gut, causing bloating and gas. So pretty much, there's no benefit at all to the carbs in soy. Now second, and this is a big one, we talked about industrial seed oils. Was that episode one of the series, Industrial Seed Oils?
Yes, it was.
It was? Okay. Because that was like the easiest, like low-hanging fruit, talking about how bad industrial seed oils are. And the oil in soy is horrible. And just to get oil from soy is like a real messy process. Like first, there has to be mechanical pressing using heat and pressure to extract the oil. And then the residual oil left in the soybean meal is then extracted using a solvent called hexane. What is hexane? You know what hexane is a part of?
Is that like motor oil?
Yeah, sure as shit. Gasoline. Okay? Oh. That's what hexane is a part of. Since hexane is a toxin, this solvent then needs to be removed from the oil. And this removal process uses steam and vacuums. The oil now needs to be bleached to remove the impurities from the oil. And now this rancid shit needs to go through a deodorization process to remove oxidation products in the oil. And all of this happens at temperatures around 220 degrees centigrade. And the problem we know about industrial seed oils is they're super highly prone to oxidation. They're super unstable. So what do you think all this shit does to the oil?
I'm sure it oxidizes it.
The shit out of it, right? All this pressure, all this heat, it's horrible, right? So that's how you get the oil from out of these beans. And we talked about the omega-6 fat linoleic acid. That's a pro-inflammatory fat that is in these industrial seed oils that's really causing the problem. So I did some math, and I want to know if you've ever heard it put this way, because I've never heard it put this way. If I tell you that 50% of 1 tablespoon of soy oil is linoleic acid, you're like, okay, whatever, bro, right?
Yeah.
That's about 7 grams of linoleic acid. Now, just to put this in perspective, how much beef would you have to eat? Just guess. Have you already read this?
I'm looking at it right now.
How much beef, just before you read that, would you have to eat to get 7 grams of linoleic acid?
Well, I would just think, like, I don't know, maybe double the amount of soy, 3 times the amount of soy, somewhere around there.
It is crazy. Let me break down these numbers. So beef tallow, which is the fat in beef, is 1.1% linoleic acid. Now, in comparison, soy oil is 50% linoleic acid. So in 1 tablespoon of beef tallow, you get 0.12 grams of linoleic acid. So that's almost 60 more times linoleic acid in the soy oil. So for me to get 7 grams of linoleic acid, I just use the example of 90-10 grass-fed ground beef, because that's pretty common. Most people know ground beef, you know?
Yeah.
I would have to eat 14 pounds of ground beef to get 7 grams of linoleic acid. Have you ever heard that?
Compared to 1 tablespoon.
1 tablespoon of soy oil. And mind you, with those 14 pounds of ground beef, Lord knows if anyone could ever eat that much, you're getting what? Protein, vitamins, fats, every vitamin and mineral the body needs. Not just omega-6 fats.
Damn, that's crazy.
That should be said more. I feel like that conversion is never made. Like, people say, oh, it's a lot of omega-6 fats, but we're talking so much more omega-6 fats than our body has ever seen, ever. Because it's true, omega-6 fats are essential, but not in that quantity.
Yeah, and soy oil is in everything. It's hard to find, like, a salad dressing that doesn't have it.
Yeah, good luck.
Or pretty much almost, like, anything that has some sort of fat in it, usually it's soy oil.
Yes. You know why? Because soy oil is cheap as shit, people, and they're making money off you buying this crap. So soy oil is poison. The soy and fat is trash. Like, definitely don't eat it. And I wonder if you, like, now you're obviously on the bandwagon that soy protein probably isn't the best, right?
I used to think that it was complete, like, I don't know, about 6-7 years ago. Mm-hmm. But yeah, after looking into it a little bit more, it's really lacking in methionine.
Mm-hmm. It is really lacking in methionine. And I guess a little backstory, me and Tom both used to work at GNC. And I remember, I remember the label. It was a blue label. What was that brand? It was like a mix of proteins. And soy was one of them. Do you remember?
Are you talking about Isopure?
No, it wasn't Isopure. It was like blue and silver. I can picture the bottle in my head, but I forget. But one of the benefits was like, oh, this one has soy in it. It was, like, spun as, like, a good thing, right? It was on the front of the label. And so for the longest time, I thought soy protein was decent, and that's the narrative for sure. But I'm going to tell you why soy protein is shit and why you think it's good. It's because, I mean, we've been scammed. So, like Tom said, soy protein is lacking the amino acid methionine, and this is known as a limiting amino acid. And the way our body, I guess, digests and metabolizes protein, it's not like a straight line. Think of it like a spider web or a Christmas tree. Like, it's all interconnected. So it only takes one of these limiting amino acids to slow down or even shut down the body's protein manufacturing process. And proteins are everywhere in our body. So there are over 50,000 different types of proteins, all built from the building blocks of amino acids. So for a protein to be considered good quality, it must at least contain all essential amino acids. And you want to tell them the difference of essential amino acids, non-essential?
So we have 20 amino acids total. You can kind of just think of these as like letters of the alphabet. 9 of them are essential. So essential means that you can only get them through diet, that our body can't make them. But outside of the 9 essential ones, we have some that are conditionally essential as well. So yeah, maybe your body can make it, but it relies on other amino acids too. So if you're lacking in an amino acid, it's like, hey, you know, I have to write an essay, but I can only use 5 E's for this essay.
Yeah.
Like, that's what happens if you're lacking in one amino acid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I really like that metaphor. That's true. So, how exactly did, like, soy get marketed as a quality protein? Even though there is technically a little bit of methionine in there, but there's not enough to count, right? So, it should have never tested good on these, like, protein quality tests. Like, it always should have been, like, a shitty protein. Well, guess what? It did always test shitty on these protein quality tests. So in 1919, scientists came up with a PER, so protein efficiency ratio. Milk got 100, beef got a score of 82, and soy got a score of 70. And that was the highest value for any sort of plant source with soy, and 70, and 70 is crap, right? So another big test was biological value. Whey got a score of 104, whole eggs got a score of 100, and soy protein got a score of 74. So again, soy is far behind any sort of animal source of protein, because animal sources of protein have a complete amino acid profile. And it's not just they have all the essential amino acids, those conditionally essential amino acids, and the other just 11 non-essential amino acids they have in the correct quantities to be considered a good protein. So soy always was considered a shit protein. What happened? It wasn't until the creation of the PDCAA test, which stands for Protein Digestibility Corrected Amino Acid Score, that soy all of a sudden became a quality protein. So, and I think they use that name to make it sound legit. That's what I found after typing this out. Doesn't that sound legit?
Oh, it sounds really, like, impressive.
Fancy as shit, yeah. Right? So I think that's part of the marketing, and it's all about marketing with this. So for this test, milk got a score of 100, eggs got a score of 100, soy got a score of 100, and beef got a score of 92.
That doesn't sound right.
Sounds a little fishy.
Yeah, I don't see how beef can get a 92.
And soy gets a score of 100. Okay, so what's going on there? So there's a few problems with this scale. The problem one is that no score can be over 100. So pretty much what that means is every A student and every C student look exactly the same. Because even on this score, milk and eggs would test over 100, but they round down, therefore making eggs and soy look the same. Okay, so what else is going on with this? So the PDC-AAS test doesn't take into account where the protein was digested. So it measures amino acids in the stool. So this allows a chance for protein in the large intestines, or the large intestines for protein to be absorbed there. And what, does that sound weird to you? Where does our body absorb proteins?
The small intestine.
Right?
Large intestine's just bacteria that's just taking care of the leftovers.
Who cares, right?
Yeah.
We don't care about that. If we're talking about quality protein sources, we don't measure it there. Okay, so now there's another test. This is the test I'm behind. It's called a DIASS, or Digestible Indispensable Amino Acid Score. So this one measures amino acid digestibility at the end of the small intestines. The scores aren't capped at some like made up high point. And this score or this test uses pigs and humans to find these values. And pigs are a pretty good model. Some of these other ones use like mice and rats. So that's why their values can be a little whack. So on this test, whole milk got a score of 1.32. Whey isolate got a score of 1.25. Eggs got a score of 1.13. Beef got a score of 1.1. Do you want to read? Are you reading this? What did the score? What did tofu get?
I don't see a 1 there. It looks like a 0.52.
0.52. That's, and it's crazy. For something to be considered a quality protein, it has to have at least a score of 0.75. At least.
Well, that makes a lot more sense now that it's half as much as beef. That looks a lot better.
Looks a lot better, right? And mind you, that is the highest source from plant foods. All the other plants are way below that, and I'll get into that. But, so with this score, like, with the DIASS scale, soy cannot be considered a quality protein. But with the PDC-AAS scale, soy could be considered a good source of protein. And there is a little caveat I had to add this, is that soy isolate, so like a soy protein powder, got a score of 1. But that's the best, like, possible example because you're just pretty much isolating this protein powder. So you can kind of make up for that methionine deficiency. But how much tofu would you have to eat to get that much methionine? We're talking pounds. But you can get that in one scoop of soy isolate. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and soy isolate's not natural.
It's not a whole food. Exactly. Yeah. We're comparing it with other whole foods. Yeah. So, again, on the DIAS scale, peanut butter, which is another, like, people talk about, oh, peanut butter is a good source of protein, got a score of 0.46. Peas got a score of 0.73. And almonds got a score of 0.4. So it just shows you the protein in these things that people claim to be good, when you actually look at the protein that's digested by humans, it's actually crap. You don't even count it as protein.
So does that mean pea protein is a better protein, like, plant-based source than soy?
Yeah.
Looks like it.
It looks like it, yeah. And I would agree with that. But, yeah, so looking into the studies, and it was a study on the DIAS scale. They mentioned, this is a quote from them, so the PDC-AAS values, and again, that's the old shitty metric, were generally higher than a DIAAS value, especially for the poor quality proteins. What does that sound like to you? We're making the bad shit look good?
They're grading on a curve, a very, very generous curve.
Very, very generous curve, exactly. So I wonder where this scale came up with and who did it benefit? It benefited food manufacturers, right? So I'm going to tell you exactly when this scale came into play. So in 1978, there was a conference in Keystone, Colorado that literally came up with ways to make soy look good. It was paid for by, like, the soy industry. Like, it was funded by them. You know, you hear, like, studies funded by Coke to make Coke look good. This was a conference to make soy look good. And literally a quote from one of these people there was, "We are mainly trying to help the food industry. Because if we can say this is a quality protein source, the soy, we can get this dirt cheap shit, sell at an up cost because now it's healthy and make more money." So the end result, they came up with a PDC-AAS scale. So the food industry didn't care about if it was a good quality source or not, good protein source or not. They just cared if they could market it as a good protein source.
Wait, so the food industry isn't looking out for our health? They're crazy. Just trying to make money?
Yeah.
Damn, that's so new.
It sucks, man. It really sucks. That's interesting, right? That whole little history?
Yeah, I'm surprised it only goes back to 78.
Well, before that, soy was never really... There's a narrative that soy has like been this staple food in Asia forever. And that's not true either. That's been spun by the soy industry to make soy appear better than what it was. At best, it's a condiment over there. No one's really eating this shit 24/7, 365. Unless you're like a monk and you want to be like abstinent. Like you don't want to... You don't like be tempted. Yeah, bro, eat soy every day. You'll never look at a woman again. You know?
I mean, it's usually... like they talk about like the Japanese people with soy. But Japan's an island. They fish a lot. They also eat a ton of fish.
Ton of fish.
Yeah.
And a ton of pork. They love pork over there, too. So, okay. So that was my first, like, salvo. Tackle the carbohydrates. They're shit. Our body doesn't even digest them. Tackle the fat. It's full linoleic acid in a crazy amount. It's poison. Tackle the protein. The protein is complete crap. It cannot be considered a quality source of protein.
So it's not fitting your macros.
It is not fitting your macros at all. Exactly. But like Tom mentioned earlier, there are macronutrients and there are micronutrients. So what's going on with these micronutrients? Would you think soy would be full of whatever, iron, magnesium, calcium?
It's got to be something other than fiber. Let's see. Vitamin C, maybe.
You would think, right? So there are vitamins and minerals in soy, right? There are. The thing is, there's this class of proteins called anti-nutrients in soy in such high amounts that it pretty much negates any value of these vitamins and minerals. And that's why with these formulas, just go look at the back of any sort of baby formula. It's going to be three paragraphs long because they're adding in all these supplements. So all these vitamins and minerals aren't coming from the actual soy oil, the soy protein, because there's none there. They have to overcompensate by supplementing with vitamins and minerals. So pretty much, if you feed your kid this soy formula, you're feeding them a supplement. That's where the nutrition is coming from. And that's the thing. The nutrition label doesn't take into account the bioavailability of said nutrients. So we want nutrients and vitamins and minerals specifically to come from their most bioavailable source, which is real foods. And so why is the bioavailability so poor? And like I said, it's anti-nutrients. And they pretty much hinder our body's ability to absorb nutrients. They can do this by chemically binding to vitamins and minerals, making them indigestible, or they can cause physical damage to our GI tract, compromising your ability to absorb the nutrients in food. And that's actually a big deal. Like, our body is designed to absorb nutrients like zinc, iron, and calcium in the correct amounts at the correct times. So when an anti-nutrient is digested and binds to calcium, like an oxalate would, it not only can make you calcium deficient, but it can also hinder your body's ability to absorb iron or zinc. Because these things kind of happen in pairs at the same time. So this can compromise various bodily functions needed for proper growth and development. And it's like our body, like I said, the protein metabolism, it's like a Christmas tree. Everything's so intertwined. So when you get these weak links, it can affect you in more ways than one. And I'm sure after the donut podcast, you don't want to hear me talk about lectins anymore. You're probably the same way. You're probably over lectins, right?
Yeah, you ruined donuts for me. I got several messages of... this last week about how I ruined donuts for them too. People are upset right now.
I know, right? So I'm not going to take a deep dive in lectins at all. If you want to know more about lectins, check out the donut podcast and just brief overview. Gluten is a lectin. It can damage our GI tract. It can lead to autoimmune diseases. And of course, lectins are in soy as well. But the lectins in soy are even worse. So there's another anti-nutrient in soy called a saponin. And if you remember lectins, they bind to glycoproteins or glycolipids on the outside of our cell. So pretty much the sugars on the outside of our cell, compromising cellular function. While saponin will bind to cholesterol on the outside of our cell. And cholesterol is really embedded in our cell membrane. It acts as an anti-nutrient and it acts as support, like structural support. So what do you think happens when something binds to the glycoproteins and the cholesterol at the same time on these outer cell walls?
And it seems like it's really going to damage like all sort of cell signaling.
Exactly.
They're not
going
to be able to communicate at all.
At all. Everything kind of goes to shit. And they've done studies, so the combination of lectins and saponins together, it's not just additive, it's exponential. So the lectin, the saponin, together in soy are 100 times more potent when tested together. There's just so much shit in soy, it blows your mind, you know? And saponins, as well as binding to cholesterol, they inhibit the enzyme succinate dehydrogenase, which is a key player in the citric acid cycle. And we've talked about that. What happens when our mitochondria go to shit?
The rest of our body does, pretty much.
It's so important. So this will affect our mitochondrial respiration, which is a bad thing. They can bind to trypsin and chymotrypsin, reducing your body's ability to absorb protein. They can cause enlargement of the thyroid, also known as goiters. And the only way to really get rid of saponins is through alcohol extraction. Like, normal cooking of a soybean or heating of a soybean won't get rid of the saponins. So it's really resistant to cooking. The next class of anti-nutrients in soy are protease inhibitors. And so, just a little background, I guess, on protein metabolisms. Our body uses enzymes to break down food into their simple building blocks before they are absorbed in our GI tract. So to break down proteins, the pancreas will release a class of enzyme called proteases. And their job is to break down full proteins into individual amino acids. And the first one discovered and the best understood protease is called trypsin. And so the protease inhibitors in food bind to trypsin, making it unable to break down proteins. And it's not just soy that protease inhibitors are in. They're in a lot of things. So they're found in grains, nuts, seeds, vegetables of the nightshade family, like potatoes, tomatoes, and eggplants. Even things like broccoli and Brussels sprouts, like, you'll find protease inhibitors there as well. The thing is, like, if they're so bad, how come, you know, we're all not just shriveling up from protein deficiency, right? Well, the thing is, traditionally, few of these foods cause any health problems because they were rarely eaten every day, and because cooking deactivates most of the protease inhibitors. However, the protease inhibitors in soybeans are more numerous and more resistant to neutralization by cooking and processing. That goes back to something you said, like, when in history do we eat the same plant every day?
There's no way you could do it. Maybe if you lived on a tropical island, maybe, because then you don't really have seasons. Like, that would be the only case. Yeah. And that's very, very, like, few select people.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, the fruit would be what? Like, coconuts? You know what I mean? Like, it's just, because we get, something we do a lot with our clients is we have them send us pictures of food. And we see all the time, people just gravitate towards a handful of vegetables all the time.
Yeah, I mean, hey, broccoli's good for you. So I'm going to eat broccoli today, tomorrow, the next 70 days in a row. Maybe take a break for a week and then eat it again for the next 90 days in a row.
Yeah, so there's nothing natural with that. And that's why these things come into play. You're getting it all the time. And specifically with soy, all the anti-nutrients in soy are so resilient to cooking, so they just stay in our blood supply. So these protease inhibitors, they force the food manufacturers to add vitamins and minerals and amino acids and other nutrients to compensate for these protease inhibitors, or unless these, like, drinks that they make wouldn't be able to properly, like, feed a baby, the baby just simply wouldn't grow. So that's why you see on the back of these lists, like, a huge list of extra added vitamins and minerals.
So how can it be considered a good protein source if it inhibits protein absorption?
It seems kind of contradictory, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not even like I said, the protease inhibitors in most of these plants, if you cook your plant, they're going to go away. Like, it's not a problem, but with soy, they don't. Like, they stick around, so that's a problem. You know a little bit, you listened to some lady, a podcast about oxalates, right?
Yeah, I know a little bit about
it. Like, it's going to be, like, we've talked about it before, this is going to be the next, like, gluten. People are going to know about oxalates.
I hear a lot of people, like, on some of the carnivore pages talking about how bad it is all the time. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people just know oxalates, and that's, like, the next buzzword.
It is a buzzword. Yeah, yeah. Buzzword. Yeah, it is. So I did a little bit more research into oxalates because I initially wrote a paper on anti-nutrients, and my assumption was that oxalates were only bad once they bound to calcium and caused kidney stones. But it turns out that's not the case. So specifically, oxalates are corrosive compounds which naturally occur in plant foods and interfere with iron, calcium, and magnesium absorption. And plants use oxalates to regulate their own internal mineral content and help defend against predators. So unlike protease inhibitors, these compounds aren't easily removed by cooking. And these compounds are found in a variety of food groups, including spinach, rhubarb, chocolate, and peanuts, with the highest being in spinach. And a little fact is, thanks to oxalates, virtually none of the iron in spinach makes it into your body because it's bound up in oxalates. Your body never absorbs it. In a healthy individual that doesn't have a leaky gut, oxalates bind to calcium in the intestines, which then get excreted in the feces. So the biggest problem here is the lack of calcium absorption, which in the grand scheme of things probably isn't that big of a deal, right? We have a lot of calcium around. However, if you have a leaky gut, the oxalates can pass through your intestinal wall and into the bloodstream. When this happens, they have to be expelled by the kidneys. That's the only way out. So while the oxalates are making this journey, they are binding the calcium the entire way, and then this can eventually lead to kidney stones in your kidneys. And, well, no shit, kidney stones are in your kidneys. But, I mean, I've never had a kidney stone, but, I mean, they say they're really painful. So that's what that was my initial, that's actually a post I written a long time ago. But there's this lady called Sally Norton, who's like the, I don't know, I guess I call her the oxalate lady. She's like, she knows a lot about it. So I kind of went through a little bit in the research she's published. And so it turns out just going through the kidneys can cause damage. It doesn't have to be bound to calcium. So this is a quote from her. It is now well established, well, from a study she, I guess, posted. It is now well established that high oxalate levels have direct toxic effects on renal tubular cells, and numerous experiments point out that oxalate itself may be injurious to renal epithelial cells. So just having the high level oxalate in our blood, and again, oxalate shouldn't be in our blood, to get through that leaky gut can injure our kidneys. Did you know that?
I didn't.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. One thing I do want to point out, though, is like spinach and some of the other foods that you listed, those are generally really high in calcium, iron, and magnesium. So even though that they are binding to them, is it still going to be a net negative when it comes to absorbing that?
I don't know if it's a net negative, but you're definitely not getting what it says it's in there.
Okay.
Because like I said before, with the nutrition label on the back of a food, or even if you look it up online, like the amount of magnesium in spinach, it doesn't take into account the oxalate content. It just takes into account the magnesium content. And so it's definitely going to be less, for sure. And actually, this next point is actually going to be, I guess, highlighted even more. The next anti-nutrient is called a phytate. And phytates are real similar to oxalates. So again, they just bind to iron, zinc, and magnesium, making them inaccessible to the body. So they pretty much act like mineral magnets that interfere with our body's ability to absorb these minerals. And seeds use this clever molecule to hold on to precious minerals so they can't be washed away in the soil while waiting to sprout. It's just unfortunate that these seeds don't just selfishly hoard their own minerals. Like, these phytates actually take minerals from us. So you see, I posted this picture, and I'm going to post this picture on the website too, of like plasma zinc levels when someone eats oysters. So oysters are very high in zinc, and I guess a little fun fact. You know oysters are considered aphrodisiac? Do you know why?
It seems like everything's considered an aphrodisiac at some point. Some culture somewhere believes it.
Something is, yeah, right? But the thing around oysters is they're very high in zinc, and zinc is a cofactor in our body's ability to produce testosterone. So let's say you're, I don't know, some man, you're struggling, you're eating wheat every day, and I'm like, man, nothing's working. You eat this can of oysters, you get this boost of zinc, and now your body's actually capable of producing testosterone. So it kind of makes sense that people would correlate that to be an aphrodisiac. They did a test, and they fed these people oysters, and they measured the amount of zinc in their blood. So after about 3 hours, there was 160 nanograms per deciliter just eating oysters. Now they paired oysters with black beans, and there's phytates in black beans. Now, after 3 hours, there's only about 40 nanograms per deciliter. So that's four times less, going from 160 to 40. Now, they pair these oysters with a corn tortilla with phytates in it and everything else in our tortilla. Now, there was literally less zinc in our blood than there was prior. Like, it literally stole zinc from us. And that just shows how strong these anti-nutrients can be. Now, the next thing in soy are goitrogens and phytoestrogens. And I paired them up because in soy, the phytoestrogens are goitrogens, even though in other things they're not. They're kind of separate. So what is a goitrogen? And you've heard of a goiter, you know what that is, right?
Enlarged thyroid.
Enlarged thyroid, right? So that's a pretty common thing. That's why you see a lot of our salt pretty much around the world is supplement with iodine. That's how people get iodine in their diet, especially in, like, you know, third world countries, places where, you know, food can be scarce sometimes. So the main job of the thyroid gland is to combine the salt iodine with the amino acid tyrosine to make thyroid hormone. Whenever the thyroid gland has a hard time making enough thyroid hormone, it becomes stressed and grows to try to do its job better, forming a goiter, which is an enlarged thyroid. So substances that interfere with normal thyroid function are called goitrogens because they have the potential to cause goiter. So these are found in the ever-popular broccoli and cabbage and Brussels sprouts and rapeseed. And you might be thinking, man, what's rapeseed?
Did you forget a G?
Yeah, what's going on there? Why don't you tell them what rapeseed is?
That's like the most popular oil that people consume on a daily basis, canola oil.
Yeah, you've had rapeseed before. Yeah, exactly. It's canola
There's oil. There's no G. It's pronounced rape. Yeah.
It is. Yeah, exactly. Turnips, mustard, peanuts. Like, that's where you're going to find goitrogens. And the thing is, goitrogens in most foods are usually neutralized by cooking or fermentation, right? So it's not really a problem. If you cook your broccoli, don't worry about it, right? But that's not the case with soy, because the chemicals in soy that are goitrogens are the phytoestrogens, the isoflavones. And those are the key isoflavones, at least, are genistein and diazoxide. Now, did I pronounce those right? Don't know. I've only read them. I never talked to anybody.
I wish I could tell you, but your guess is as good as mine at this point.
Right? So these are potent inhibitors of thyroid peroxidase. And that's the enzyme involved in the synthesis of T3 and T4, which is just thyroid hormone. So I put this in my notes, this little sidebar, because I wanted to talk about it. It's a blessing, really, that we've come at this more like engineers, more like people like Ivor Cummins. We've kind of came at this nutrition game with more of a broad scope. So we can kind of appreciate other people's opinions without buying hook, line, and sinker into one guy.
Well, the way like med school like teaches everything is like, hey, if you're going to be a cardiologist, the heart is the most important thing. If you're a neurologist, the brain's the most important thing. It's like everything's like that. If you're an ophthalmologist, the eyes are the most important thing. So everybody thinks like that organ's the most important part. And it's like, no, they're all equally connected. Yes. I mean, maybe not the eyes. You can live without eyesight. You can't live without a heart or a brain. But yeah.
But yeah, exactly. But everyone, for whatever reason, like they just think their shit is the most important shit. And I, looking at this podcast, like I went into like everyone's little field. They just thought it was so important. Like when I studied on lectin, like this lectin guy I really looked into, he thought everything under the sun was caused by lectins. And he has a point. Like lectins aren't good, but is everything caused by lectins? Probably not. You know what I mean? Like, probably not. So, looking into this one, the oxalate lady, I think Sally Norton again, I might be getting her name wrong, I'm not sure. But she says to eat rutabaga instead of potatoes because they are lower in oxalates.
But what is a rutabaga?
It's like another...
It's like a celery looking thing?
No, I think it's...
That's rhubarb.
Huh? Yeah, it's rhubarb, yeah. Rutabaga, it almost looks like a potato. Okay. Similar, yeah. And, but you know what the goitrogen lady said to not eat? Rutabaga, because rutabaga is extremely high in goitrogens. And I was like, oh, these people, like, they're living in these little silos, and they're not really, you know what I mean? Like, they can't see the forest despite the trees, you know?
So it's like a turnip or a cabbage? I guess it's in the cabbage family.
Is it in the cabbage family? Okay. So that's the thing. I just thought that was so funny. That, like, one second, this lady's like, oh, oxalates cause everything. Don't eat potatoes. And then the next, like, oh, goitrogens are causing everything. Don't eat rutabaga. You know what I mean? It's just funny to me. I thought that was a kick. So, I don't know why that is, but it is what it is.
I mean, if you're really smart about it and you mix up, like, the vegetables, and you just kind of pick, oh, okay, this one's higher in oxalates, I'll do this one today. And then I'll get a low oxalate food the next day. Maybe it's higher in this. And you just kind of spread out the anti-nutrients. That's probably, like, a good way to go about it. And if you're, like, eating them seasonally, instead of just, like, overloading on broccoli day after day after day.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, if you don't want to go carnivore, eating seasonal is very smart. Because you're not going to give your body the same toxin every single day. Because our body's super resilient. It can handle a ton. But after, you know, 30, 40 years of this shit, you're going to pay the price. So there's another goitrogen in soy called thiocyanate. And again, this blocks iodine absorption in the thyroid, which blocks that enzyme thyroid peroxidase. And the only reason I brought this up, trust me, there's more shit in soy, but I had to cut this list off somewhere. I'm already at like 7 pages of notes. I brought this one up, this thiocyanate, because you know what it's in? It's in broccoli. And it's a compound that there's a special lady out there, Rhonda Patrick, who loves sulforaphane. That is a thiocyanate. It's so toxic. It mixes with another chemical in broccoli. I forget the other chemical now, and forms sulforaphane. But that in itself is a goitrogen. So it's just, this shit is complicated. You know what I mean? But I just wanted to bring that up. And lastly, there's something called a soya toxin. And this one's fairly new. We just discovered it fairly recently. They thought it was a lectin for a really long time, but it's not. And it's a toxic protein that causes clotting like a lectin. And it's only been studied like in mice, so it's lethal to mice. It caused difficulties breathing, convulsions, and partial paralysis prior to death. So I just wanted to add that in there because this shit is killing mice left and right. And nothing in humans so far, but it can't be good. Something called soy toxin can't be good, you know?
Yeah, the name alone kind of gives away what it does.
Super specific, yeah.
Yeah, I know we're not mice, but that's where we get overwhelmingly, like, the majority of our, like, medical research done. Especially when it comes to, like, nutrition and anything else. So maybe we can't make apple-to-apple comparisons.
Yeah, one-to-one.
But, you know, it's still pretty close.
It can lead us down a path to look into. You know what I mean? Like, if it's killing these fuckers dead, we might want to look into it. So,
well, I don't want to volunteer for those, like, randomized control trials.
Yeah, me neither. But, so yeah, that's kind of where I wanted to end it with just the toxins in soy and why, like, when you're feeding your baby this infant formula that contains soy oil, soy protein, you're feeding them these chemicals, and it's just sad, you know? Like, I'm not particularly anti-soy from a traditional standpoint. There's food like tempeh and like natto, and they're fermented soy beans. And we've talked about this, like, when we tell any, I don't recommend us anybody, but when we do, we have them do something to make them more bioavailable.
Yeah, fermentation is a great way to get through a lot of those anti-nutrients. The bacteria will take care of them for you.
And we talk about something like ancient knowledge.
Yeah.
That's old. That's not new. Like, we've been doing fermentation forever. You know what I mean? Like, that's something we could have done back in the day without a fridge, without electricity.
I mean, they probably figured it out by mistake.
They just let something sit there.
Yeah. Hey, I'm hungry. I have no food around. Well, this has been sitting around for 3 weeks. Let me go eat it. Oh, hey, I don't feel sick.
Yeah, I didn't die. It kind of tastes a little funky, but that's okay. Yeah, that's most likely how fermentation came about. But if you do that with soybeans and you get this traditional food, that's okay, you know? And it's okay, like, as a supplement, or excuse me, as a condiment. That's usually how it's been eaten in traditional Asian countries, as a condiment. Think of how we put ketchup on eggs or mustard on eggs as a condiment. They would do the same thing with soy as, like...
You put mustard on eggs?
Oh, for sure, because I'm, like, anti-sugar. When I don't put shit on eggs anymore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but back in the day to cut, sugar down.
Yeah, really?
Oh, I'll do fucking
never heard of that before. That's nasty.
Oh, yeah, no, I've done that, yeah. But, yeah, so I'm particularly not anti-soy in that sense. Like, you know, if you want to do that, go ahead. But don't get it twisted. Like, that doesn't make it healthy. It just makes it less bad. And you wonder why soy has all this crap in it. It's because it really was never designed to be eaten by humans. Like, soy is a natural fertilizer. If you didn't know, soy is, what are beans? Legumes.
Okay.
Right? So soy is a legume, and they have a special property of able to fix nitrogen. So nitrogen in the air comes in the form of N2. So it's just N nitrogens paired up together, two nitrogens. Now, for us, for you, for animals, that really don't mean shit. We need nitrogen to be by itself. So these legumes have the ability to fix nitrogen. So if you plant soy in a field, it'll fix nitrogen from the atmosphere and deposit it in the soil for the plants to use. It's almost like it's perfect. That's what it's designed to do. It's a natural, it's a green fertilizer. So in, like, cover crop or in between seasons, like, if you want to plant some soy to get nitrogen in the soil naturally and not have to rely on, like, oil to produce nitrogen for you, then yeah, man, soy's great, do that. But to dig this shit up, process it, split it up into this protein and this fat, and call it healthy and serve it to people, that's what I have a problem with.
So is that what was happening? Farmers were smart and were using it as a, like, in between crops, and then they're like, well, now we have all this soy, what are we going to do with it? Oh, let's make it into food.
Pretty much they knew that they can give it to animals, and the animals, they would get sick, but they would survive enough if they gave them methionine. I'm like, well, shit, man, we gave it to these pigs. They didn't die. What if we separate this bean into the fat and the protein? We mark it up 100x. We can make so much money off this waste product. And that's what they did.
Yeah, there's, like, no saturated fat in it, so it fits that
my narrative.
That diet heart hypothesis, yeah.
Right away, yeah. And it's just real, real scheming, real shady, and... But, I mean, I will thank soy. If it wasn't for that conversation with Dave, I would have never made the site. I would have never... Because we had talked about me and Tom personally talked about doing a podcast before that event happened. Like, we were both like, you know, we're on to something, and like, this shit's not right. Like, we need to, you know, spread the word. But talking about something and doing something are completely different things, you know? So after I talked to David, it was, I mean, God, it was a few weeks later where I was working on the site, and I was like, we got this podcast together, and we're like, all right, we're doing this. And because I wasn't going to let that happen to people I care about. And so thank you, Soy, for that.
Well, I'm surprised there was not as many cuss words as I was expecting.
Because you know I've been waiting for this.
Yo, yeah. It was a little bit shorter than I anticipated it to be, too. I thought we were going to be here for like 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah, I guess I was a little busy this week. I was doing this in-between stuff. But
well, I think you got a lot of this out of your system last week with lectins.
I did. Yeah, I definitely did. Lectins are a big one for sure. Yeah, and I did pull a lot of that from my Soy notes. So, yeah. But just in recap, man, Soy sucks. Don't eat it. Please don't feed it to your kids. Like, they're so young. They're so, you know, vulnerable to these things. And another thing I didn't touch on was like the phytoestrogens, and how there are so many kids nowadays, like especially girls, that are hitting puberty and they're 9 and 10 years old. Like, you've heard about that.
Oh yeah. I would bet the majority of our population is some sort of estrogen dominance.
Exactly.
How many men have low testosterone?
Yeah. And feminine features, all stuff. Yeah. Like, that's a real problem. And I didn't really want to get into it too much because that conversation is complex, and honestly, that would have taken me way longer to look into, but that is a problem, and Soy, I think, is a huge player in that, and I also think plastic, and just, there's a lot of synthetic estrogen in our environment, so that's why I didn't get into it. It's not just a Soy problem, but Soy is, well, Soy ain't helping.
Also, oh, that's that. For sure.
Yeah, it's not helping.
So. And it's weird, is I don't hear, I mean, other than people taking, like, steroids, like, who has abnormally high testosterone? It's all going the other way.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's never that way. Like, yeah. No one's walking around, I'm walking around 1,000 grams of test every day. Never.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. But you see plenty of people walk around nice and chubby. You know what I mean? You see guys with boobs every day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I try not to judge people. I'm just like, I'll just see somebody, I'm like, yeah, I can help this. Like, you're either eating everything out of plastic, you're using a bunch of, like, crappy products on your skin, probably combination. You're probably consuming stuff with a lot of soybean oil. Like, it's, you know, it's all of it. I don't think it's just one of them.
Yeah, I don't think it's one of them either, but it's just, I don't know. Maybe eventually we can do a podcast on that. I'll have to look into it, but it's a big problem. So I think, you think I cover Soy enough?
I think so.
Did you learn anything? I was trying to teach people.
What was that stat at the beginning? The 60 times more omega-6s? Or is it specifically linoleic
acid? Linoleic acid, yep.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that blew my mind.
Yeah, use that, please. When we're having arguments about Soy, drop that bomb.
I was thinking 3 to 4 times as much.
60.
Like, maybe 5 at the most. 60? Mm-hmm. Damn.
Yeah, crazy. So, did you have a tip of the week this week?
Yeah, this one, I'm just going to give you guys my favorite workout that I'm doing right now. It is incredibly easy. Well, it's not easy. It's simple. It doesn't require...
Yeah, the point is, it's not easy.
Yeah. Well, it's simple. It's intense, it's brief, you don't need any equipment, all you need is some running shoes. Actually, I guess you don't even really need some running shoes. You can do this barefoot.
If you're a gangster.
Yeah. But it's the most difficult workout of my week, and it pushes me to my limits every time. When I'm done with this workout, it's pretty much when I'm like, all right, I'm either going to throw up or I'm going to run again. I'm just like, you know, let me just keep going, or let me just go home.
Yeah, just stop.
That's usually like my cue to leave. So this workout is just running up a hill. That's it. Not complicated, and it's a great workout. So the hardest part is just finding like the appropriate size hill. You want it to be about 10 to 30 seconds like for you to sprint from the bottom to the top. Any less than 10 seconds, it's not a big enough hill. If you're going over 30 seconds, you're not sprinting. Nobody in the world can sprint over 30 seconds, not even Usain Bolt.
I feel like at some point we need to talk about that. Because I've had that conversation with a few people. Like, oh, I do sprints for a minute. I'm like, no, you don't.
No, that's not a sprint.
Like, no, you don't. No, but I'm going as fast as I can. No, you're not. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, like, a sprint is, like, 8 to 12 seconds. Like, the 100-meter dash, that's a sprint. Like, the 200-meter dash, they're not sprinting the whole way. They can't. Mm-hmm. Our body is not capable of sprinting for longer than, like, 12 seconds.
And you can just look at the time. Just double the 100 meters, and it's not as fast. I mean, it's slower than the 200 meters. You know what I mean? They don't keep that pace.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, like any more than 30 seconds, it's too big. So try and find one smaller, or you can just sprint for 30 seconds up a big ass hill, not make it to the top, and then walk back down. And that's all the rest period is for me, is just walking from the top of the hill back down to the bottom. As soon as I'm at the bottom of the hill, time to sprint back up it. And the warm-up is incredibly easy. You walk to the top of the hill, walk back down. If it's a small hill or you're kind of stiff that day, maybe walk up and down it a couple times so you know your body's nice and warm, your joints are all loosened up. And this, the workout itself is usually only like 4 to 8 sprints. Usually 5 is like my go-to. Right around that 5th one is when I feel like I'm going to throw up. And it's like, okay, I think I pushed myself pretty hard right now so I can go home. And like my cool down is just as easy as walking down to the bottom of that hill and then walking back to the car. It's really simple, really easy. It's my favorite type of workout. So it's basically just HIIT training. Everybody has heard the term HIIT training, high intensity interval training. So if you want to get high intensity, there's not much higher intensity than sprinting, especially when you throw in that elevation. And since you're sprinting uphill, you're lowering the impact on your joints quite a bit because like your steps are a lot smaller, so you don't have like a full stride length to gain all that extra momentum. If you try sprinting downhill, ooh, that's going to tear up your quads. That's going to tear up your knees. Like, have fun doing that.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, like, you're going to be sore for, like, 3 days after that. It's a great way to increase your heart rate. And when you increase your heart rate to, like, its maximum output, that's a great way to increase your cardiac output overall. So your cardiac output is basically just how much blood your heart is able to pump through in a given amount of time. And that's a great way to increase your VO2 max, which is really how people measure, like, their endurance capabilities. How good of an endurance athlete are you? So like you need to really increase your HIIT training to increase your cardiac output to increase that VO2 max. So like another thing to do when you're doing this is to take short strides. That will give you like more power. If you ever watch offensive or defensive linemen in a football game, they're not trying to take giant lumbering steps. They're taking a bunch of short little choppy steps. Their feet are constantly moving, even though they're not really moving very far.
Yeah, it actually looks funny. If you watch a video, they're moving a lot, but they don't move. You know what I mean?
It's like they're dancing on coals or something.
Yes.
Like their feet are moving, but they're not going anywhere.
No. Uh-uh.
So that's how you generate power, is you just take a lot of short strides. And another thing that really helps is you swing your arms a lot. And you want to swing them, make sure you're going in a forward direction to like, so your momentum's all going forward. And the higher you bring them, the better. So the metaphor I like to use is your hands are phones and greatness is calling. So every time you're taking a step, answer that call.
I love that. Yeah, it's such a good little metaphor.
Yeah, so that's it for the tip of the week.
That's a great tip, man. I just recently, well, shit, not recently. I'm horrible with time. But I do high-intensity interval training on my upper body days. So my cardio for a whole day will be 8 minutes long. Like, that's it. It's not 45 minutes on a treadmill. It's not walking outside for 20 minutes. It's 8 minutes long.
And it should stay 8 minutes. There's no reason to increase the volume, just to increase the intensity. The better shape you get, sprint faster.
Just go, go harder.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I don't know. I'm not going to say I like it because I don't like it. But after being done with cardio after 8 minutes, it's nice knowing, like, I have so much more time. Like, it's not a big commitment.
Oh, no, not at all.
Yeah. So you can squeeze it into your day no matter how busy your day really is.
Yeah, so I'm doing like 1 or 2 sprint sessions a week and then 1 long run a week. I'm probably getting more out of this like 10-minute workout than my 3 to 4 hour runs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's that important. It plays that big of a role.
And the reason I don't do more sprints is because you want to let your body recover. Like, if I could do sprints every day, I would, but that just wouldn't be smart, you know?
Oh, yeah, not at all. Because they are extremely intense.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's another episode in the books. Thank you for listening. You can find us at tntwellnessandnutrition.com. If any comments, questions, or concerns, please reach out. You can email us at tntwellnessandnutrition@gmail.com. So, please reach out.
Yeah, please rate and subscribe to the podcast. Also, rate and subscribe on our website so you can get all our tips of the week. And get these podcasts emailed to you as soon as they come out. You can find us on Apple iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Hope everybody has a happy and healthy week.